Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, we visit Fertile Ground, Art and Community in California. It's the title of a new exhibit at the Oakland Museum of California. A collaboration between the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art as part of their SF MoMA On the Go series. The exhibit just opened about a week ago at the Oakland Museum. The exhibit blends art and artifacts from both museums' collections to illuminate four periods of artistic innovation in Northern California, with a focus on the artworks and the contexts that fostered their creation. It presents a history of personal relationships, artistic breakthroughs, and social change. Artists such as Diego Rivera, Ansel Adams, Wayne Thiebaud, and Barry McGee are just some of the major artists featured. So what were the social forces that created these fertile grounds, according to the curators? And what role did government play to help these communities flourish? Is there something about the Bay Area that fostered these periods of artistic innovation? Well, joining me in the studio to discuss this unique exhibit are two of the curators of it. First, we're joined by Janet Bishop. She is the curator of painting and sculpture at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Welcome, Janet.
Thank you, Joseph.
And we're also joined by Drew Johnson. He is curator of photography and visual culture at the Oakland Museum of California. Welcome,
Hi.
Drew.
Hi, Joseph.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you the phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can go ahead and email or text us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment at the KLW website. We want to hear from you. So, Janet Bishop, I wanted to start with you from San Francisco MoMA. What led to this exhibit?
Well, when SF MoMA embarked on its expansion project, we realized that in order to create the building that we wanted, we were going to need to close our doors for a period of time. And with that in mind, we had a couple of options. One was to go dark for a couple of years, which didn't seem so appealing to anyone. Another option was to look for a facility where we could use as a kind of designated site during this period and operate a smaller version of our typical program for a period of time. But it seemed like it might be more interesting to figure out a way to share our collection, to remain active in the community by collaborating with our immediate neighbors. So we came up with this idea of partnering with museums throughout the Bay Area and opening up our collection. It's really an unprecedented opportunity to be able to go to curators and museum directors in our immediate vicinity and basically say, you know, what can we do? What can we create together at a moment when none of the pieces are needed for our own presentations? You know, 100% available. So that's how it began. And we've since closing our doors on 3rd Street just over a year ago, we've presented a kind of continuous stream of partnership exhibitions with our peers in the community.
So tell us a little bit more about this specific collaboration. Where did the idea for this one come from?
Well, we got in touch with Lori Fogarty, the director at the Oakland Museum, who's a longtime friend and colleague, and decided to get together for a meeting. And the two teams came together. Lori had a couple of curators in mind from Oakland, and some of my coworkers joined me for an initial kind of exploratory session where the big question that we had was, what can we do better together than either museum could do independently.
And so, Drew, tell us what that conversation was like for you.
Well, looking back on it, I think it all came together rather quickly. I think Janet talked about a project that the two museums could do better as a collaboration than either could do individually. And One of the things that's unique about the Oakland Museum of California is that it's an interdisciplinary museum. We do have an art gallery, but we also have a history gallery and a natural sciences gallery, and our collections span all three disciplines as well. There's an art show in the science gallery right now, for instance. But so immediately we thought of California, California connections, moments in California art history where something happened within the state. Since we are the Museum of California, we're the only museum devoted exclusively to California. We wanted to have that emphasis. We felt it really had to. But since we had the opportunity to sort of have the full resources of the SF MoMA collections, we immediately thought of moments when California art either interacted with the world, the larger world, or did something that really made the rest of the art world sit up and take notice. So that's where we came to these four moments.
So why don't you go ahead and describe those four moments for us? Because it's really critical that I think in moving the conversation forward tonight that we understand how this exhibit is structured.
Sure. The exhibit is a very large exhibition. There's over 200 artworks and I think 120 or so artists. And it covers more than 90 years of art history, I think. But it's very important to realize that it's not intended as a comprehensive history of art in California during those years. I've always been really struck by the way artists interact personally and spur each other to greater accomplishment. And, you know, there's a large degree of competitiveness worked in there. And I'm primarily a photography curator, and the great example of that locally is Group F64, a group of Bay Area photographers in the 1930s, included Ansel Adams and Edward Weston and Imogen Cunningham, where you really saw, you know, the sum was greater than the parts. So there's some very... it's a show that has a lot of well-known movements. These are things that California is known, very well known for. They're kind of iconic moments with iconic artworks. Since we're an interdisciplinary museum, we thought it would be great to put them in the context of what was happening in the world at the time. For instance, in the first section, which is of Diego Rivera and during the Great Depression and his arrival in San Francisco, where the general strike in San Francisco was going on at the time. And I guess I should probably list the four movements, actually. Would you
sure.
The four
That'd
sections of the show, yeah. The first one is called Diego Rivera, Murals and Public Art, Allegory of California. In 1930, a group of local patrons and artists who knew Diego Rivera, who was one of the most famous artists in the world at that time, Mexican muralist, and managed to get the city to bring him to San Francisco to create some murals. And the first one he'd worked on was at the Pacific Stock Exchange, which is now the City Club in San Francisco. And Albert Bender, whose collection was really the founding collection at the San Francisco Museum of Art, which is now the SF MoMA, got together with the people like Ralph Stackpole, the sculptor, Edward Weston, and sort of lured Diego and Frida to San Francisco, which is a very strange thing that the section on the Allegory of California, which is a mural that you can still go see at the City Club, is titled The Communist at the Stock Exchange. And he joined forces with Timothy Pfluger, who was the architect of that building. And we have, thanks to SF MoMA, we have the Pfluger's original drawings for the building. We have all of Diego Rivera's studies for the mural, which is fascinating to see the... sort of process by which, you know, compare it with the finished mural, which we have as sort of a walk-in reproduction to look at. And it basically energized the local art scene during the Depression. And so the private patronage combined with public patronage, government patronage, of course, the Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal is coming in with the Federal Art Project and the Public Works of Art Project, and Coit Tower Muralists, which was a group of 28 muralists that got together just as San Francisco waterfront was erupting in the general strike. So basically, we have combined the art sort of cheek by jowl with historic film footage, quotations from the artists, memorabilia, things like that, to really tell the story of, how the art came about.
Hmm. So then move us to the second period, Janet, that's covers the post-war period.
Right. So the second section of the exhibition takes us to the California School of Fine Arts, to Chestnut Street, to the institution now known as the San Francisco Art Institute. And this is just a fascinating moment in Bay Area art history. You had artists who were brought out to teach at the school by the visionary director, Douglas McKagey, people like Clifford Still and Mark Rothko, who had a huge impact here in the late 1940s, really helping to fuel the energy around abstract expressionism, which was at the time kind of dominant mode of expression among avant-garde artists of the day. Now, something really interesting happened during the 1950s in that a number of the artists associated with the school decided to start painting figuratively. So one of the things that we see in this exhibition is not only fantastic examples by famous Bay Area figurative artists like Richard Diebenkorn and Elmer Bischoff and David Park, but thanks to the Oakland Museum, were able to see exactly what David Park was rejecting when he took his abstract paintings to the Berkeley City dump in 1949. Oakland has one of the very few surviving examples from this period of David Park's career. They then have one of the very first figurative paintings from 1950. It's a painting called Rehearsal, where David Park paints himself and the director of the school where he was teaching and some of his friends performing music together. So it's a painting that's not only significant for being one of the first Bay Area figurative examples, but also one that depicts his own community. You see David Park at the piano, his friend Elmer Bischoff on the horn, the director of the school playing drums. And then through a later example from SF MoMA's collection, you see how Park kind of harnessed everything he had learned from abstract expressionism and reached the full height of his expressive potential later on in the 1950s with a painting we have called Two Bathers.
You mentioned, Drew, in the first section there that the New Deal and the Works Project Administration had a lot to do with the flourishing of the art in the 1930s. And then the exhibit draws a connection between the GI Bill and the growth of that what is now the San Francisco Art Institute. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Exactly. Well, the story that Janet just told is the art historical study, and I think both museums have told that story. But what I had never realized about art scene at that time was that yes, you had a visionary director in Douglas McKagey and his wife Germaine, who I think was a curator at the Legion of Honor, but he would not have been able to lure people like Clifford Still and Mark Rothko onto the faculty and attract students like Richard Diebenkorn and Elmer Bischoff and Deborah Butterfield and all those folks if it hadn't been for the GI Bill, because as progressive as he was, it was the money provided by the GI Bill and the fact that all of a sudden artists, people could go to art school and have it paid for by the U.S. government. And so that not only meant that they were able to attend and they were able to pay the faculty, but that they was attracted an older and sort of more mature group of artists that had, most of them were World War II veterans, been through the war, seen a lot. And I think it really affected their attitude towards painting and the emotion and the expressiveness of abstract expressionist painting.
And my understanding is this is also at the San Francisco Art Institute was where, or what becomes the San Francisco Art Institute, was where photography was established, so to speak, as a fine art.
Yeah, again, it's just something that I don't think a lot of people in the Bay Area who are even familiar with art realize what an important place the California School of Fine Arts, now the SFAI, was to photography. Ansel Adams and some other folks had been really lobbying for some time for a photography school that would really teach the aesthetics of photography as well as the technical aspects and the ability to sell photographs commercially. And like McKagey, he approached Douglas McKagey in 1946 with the idea of starting a fine art photography program that would pay as much attention to aesthetics as technical matters. And McKagey agreed, and he started what was really the first fine art photography program in America. And of course, being Ansel Adams and being in the Bay Area, that meant that he could call on his good friends like Edward Weston and Dorothea Lange and Imogen Cunningham and Minor White to teach at the school. And Minor White eventually took the program over.
Hmm. And then let's move now as to the 60s. and so we shift focus from San Francisco, which was a big part of the first two periods here that we're describing. We now move to Davis. How did we get to Davis?
Well, I think the social context here is the Cold War and the expansion, post-war expansion of the University of California system, which was obviously fueled with the desire to keep up with the Russians and surpass them. You take all through the UC system, really a huge amount of money, influx of money came in. And Davis, which was primarily an agricultural college and veterinary school, and some of this money fell off sort of on the side, and you really have the impression that this was almost an afterthought that, oh, here's some money for a fine art program, a studio art program. And so Richard L. Nelson, who is much like Douglas McKagey at CSFA, was tasked with forming a new art department for UC Davis. And he very deliberately, he basically cased community colleges and state colleges and high schools and put together this amazing faculty, starting off with Wayne Thiebaud and Robert Arneson, who of course founded the ceramics department there and one of the movements that California is best known for, Manuel Neri, William Wiley, and sort of created an atmosphere where they were able to basically do whatever they wanted. And you get the feeling there was great collegiality, even though they were working, very different artists working in very different ways.
And so then we come to the 90s, and this area, specifically the Mission District, is plays a prominent role in the final part of the exhibit. And this is one, Janet, that's in some ways very close to your heart as a resident of the Mission, and in many ways having lived through the first dot-com boom, and now as we're in the second one. So tell us about how this is kind of the capstone to the exhibit, how the Mission School and the artistic response to the dot-com era. How does it play into this theme that we're trying to pull together here of Bay Area as a sort of cauldron for artistic movements?
Right. So following on the heels of two sections of the show that are centered at actual schools, the last section of the exhibition, which we're calling the Mission Scene as opposed to the Mission School this time around, looks at the work of artists who emerged in the mid-1990s, where the kind of creative epicenter was the Mission District. And this is a time when the neighborhood was changing quickly, but there was still a kind of great sense of possibility. And artists like Barry McGee and Margaret Kilgallen, Ruby Neary, Alicia McCarthy, Chris Johansson were making work that that reflected a kind of can-do attitude, a sort of DIY spirit. There was a lot of collaboration going on, and a lot of the work sort of has had a very kind of homespun feel. So one of the things that's interesting about this body of work is the way so much of it crosses over into other subcultures like skateboarding and surfing and graffiti, and draws its energy from places other than other than fine art. And the exhibition looks at the sort of creative impulses that took root in the mission in the 90s, but then brings it all the way up to the present with newly commissioned work that continues to demonstrate the sort of vitality of that aesthetic.
I don't know if it occurred to you, probably it did, but that you're sort of the populist movements that started your exhibit kind of reemerge in the 90s. I'm curious at some point maybe you can unpack sort of the similarities and differences between the two periods. That was a great overview of the exhibit, and we're going to dive a little bit deeper into some of the features of it and also some of the themes that have emerged from it. But first, I want to reintroduce the program. If you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing Fertile Ground, Art and Community in California. It's a new exhibit at the Oakland Museum of California, and it's a collaboration between that museum and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. And just there, we were hearing from Janet Bishop. She is the curator of painting and sculpture at SFMOMA. And a little earlier, we heard from Drew Johnson, curator of photography and visual culture at the Oakland Museum of California. We invite you, our listeners, to dial in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us, and I gave the wrong email address at the beginning. So if you sent an email, send it again to cityvisions@kalw.org. Again, that's cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can post a comment at the KALW website. So let's go now to talk about a little bit of how you pulled these four periods together and the kind of the overarching arc that you tried to display. And specifically, I wanted you to respond to some criticism that came from the SF Chronicle this past week, basically saying that it was kind of a reach to try to pull these four periods together as somehow emblematic of some... that California or Northern California itself was setting the stage or making major contributions to the art scene. So I'm curious how you respond to that, because when I went to see the exhibit, I saw this. It was really great to see all these pieces juxtaposed to each other. But it sounds like not everyone saw the connection. Janet?
Well, I think as curators, there are always choices that we make in terms of what we want to cover in an exhibition. And one of the possibilities is that we could have attempted to do a history of California art, where we would have covered a lot more ground, but perhaps in a more cursory fashion. And what we thought might be interesting to do in this case was to take a deep dive approach. So rather than kind of skating through 100 years of California art history, to take four moments and explore those moments in the best way that we could. And that's where I think we were able to draw upon both the resources in the places where our collections overlap. I mean, clearly the Oakland Museum of California has a fantastic collection of Northern California art, and it's been an area of emphasis at SFMOMA since our inception as well. And then to think about what else we might do through archival materials and documentary materials, photographs. And so, for instance, in the opening section of the exhibition, the Oakland Museum just wouldn't be able to tell the story of murals in the 1930s with actual examples of work by Rivera were it not for loans. And so because SFMOMA is not a collection that's focused solely on California art, we had the great benefit of being the beneficiary of Albert Bender's patronage and his passion for Mexican art. That's one of the the core areas of our early collection. So that sort of came to mind immediately as a place where we might be able to do something different through the joining of the two collections than either of us could do on our own.
Drew, do you want to add something there?
Yeah, I think these are four snapshot moments that are designed to really drive home the idea of the title of the show, which is Fertile Ground, something that has happened throughout history and continues to happen. At one point in the exhibition, there's a large map of the Bay Area where visitors are encouraged to identify locations where they think Fertile Ground is happening today. So it was the idea, and then putting that in the context of personal relationships and what was going on in the larger world. So they're snapshots that are illustrated, of course, by great masterpieces from both collections. So that's kind of an appealing draw.
Well, one thing that I thought that was a great way to bring that out was the four, for lack of a better term, genealogies. Can you describe that and explain? I found those to be quite powerful.
Well, since so much of the idea for the exhibition depends on the notion of relationships, and we kept discovering new ones. I mean, right in the allegory of California mural, this almost the central figure is a kid holding a model airplane. And that kid, it turns out, is Peter Stackpole, one of the best photojournalists of the 20th century, whose father was Ralph Stackpole, who did the sculptures on the exterior of the Stock Exchange building. And we have a great collection of Peter Stackpole's works. And Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo actually lodged with the Stackpoles while they were in town. So teenage Peter Stackpole photographed Timothy Pfluger and Diego Rivera and his father, of course. So we always knew that we wanted to have a visual sort of representation, and it seemed like a web or a family tree type of chart was the way to go. And we experimented with various versions of that, including possibly an interactive one. And then we met with Amanda Eicher, who runs Adobe Books in San Francisco and did during the 1990s when the Mission Scene was at its height and was a hangout for a lot of the Mission Scene artists and a gallery, in fact, where they showed their work, and discovered that she had, before the old store closed, all around the upper walls of the bookstore, this chart linking people in the Mission Scene, artists and curators and just people involved. And we contacted her, asked her if she might be interested in recreating that it's called Genealogy, is the name of the piece, recreating that in the exhibition, and in fact, which she's done. And in fact, we had her do that with the first three sections as well. So it's all done by hand, showing the connections.
Right. And actually, I just wanted to read something from the first panel of the exhibit, which I think gets at what you're talking about. Popular culture has given us the stereotype of the solitary artist struggling in isolation against personal demons in a private quest for inspiration. Mentioned less often are the crucial but intangible factors that bring together the right people at the right place and time to spark a fury of creativity that inspires groundbreaking art. So this is what you're saying, is that you know, we do have to see the artist in context, in literally how they are tied to other artists and the time and space that they're within, that
exactly.
They exist.
It's not just a huge part of the story that mustn't be ignored. It's really a window for people that might not be versed in art history to a wedge into learning about placing it in the time, in the context of what was going on. We are sort of the prime directive at the museum is to take subjects that people might not be familiar with but that are important, and to try to provide a way for them to really get in there, even if they're not art aficionados.
So I have a question. Is this approach unique to the periods that you display, or is it saying something about or response to how exhibits are traditionally curated that may sometimes decontextualize to a certain degree the artist? Tell me, which is it here, or both?
I think we're very sensitive to decontextualizing the artists, and you mentioned the the mission scene section. And one of the things, I think one of the biggest learning experiences for me working on the show was in working with the scene where everybody's still alive pretty much, and their artists are still working, and they're still dealing with a lot of the issues of gentrification and the tech boom and so on that are occurring in San Francisco now, it made it very, very difficult to squeeze their story to historicize it and sort of put it into the framework. The first three sections of the show, those histories have been written. And there's a tendency of curators to want to sort of assign people to their place as part of a school, for instance. But if you go back and you hear to the California School of Fine Arts, for instance, Richard Diebenkorn and Hassel Smith debating whether there was such a thing as a California School of Abstract Expressionism and insisting that they weren't part of it if there was. So I don't know, Janet, did you...
Yeah, one of the things that was really exciting about working on the show is, as Drew said, working with living artists. And for the last section of the exhibition, we collaborated especially closely with Drew's colleague at the Oakland Museum, the curator Renee de Guzman. And what we decided to do was really follow the artists and take their lead on the direction of that last section. So one thing that was very important to the artists that we were in conversation with is that that section, the mission school or the mission scene, not be reduced to just a few figures who are most closely identified with it. And so the gallery includes lots and lots of loans that the artists have made to the show of the work of their friends, the people that were important to them. You'll see cases that are filled with many, many, many more works of art than we had originally planned to exhibit. And the way that Amanda Eicher's genealogy or network of names explodes in the fourth section, I think it's just indicative of how deep and rich this living history really is.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking with Janet Bishop of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and Drew Johnson of the Oakland Museum of California regarding the new exhibit at the Oakland Museum called Fertile Ground, Art and Community in California. Again, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KLW website. So let's turn now to what it, to me, was this surprising connection between government and art. So as we said earlier, as we were going through the four periods, the New Deal Works Project Administration helped to spur the public art and the murals that we see here in San Francisco and elsewhere in the country. And then we have the GI Bill helping to spur a local fine arts college to a new level. And then we have the monies from Cold War times helping UC Davis launch a new art program. Notably, there is no government funding noted in the mission scene. But walk us through that. Walk us through sort of how the intentional or unintentional ways in which government helped to spur these kinds of movements, Drew. Hmm.
Well, I'm still terribly impressed, looking back at the 1930s, that the federal government decided to get, along with all the other people that they were putting back to work, put artists back to work. And I think one of the great examples of, and it was sort of halting at first. One of the great examples in San Francisco is the Coit Tower. And that was, it seems to have been a real model for harmony among the artists. It was, like, say, over 25 artists. There had just been formed in San Francisco an Artists and Writers Union. Of course, there's a tremendous, if you look at a lot of the art in this section of the show, it's a lot of glorifying industry and the worker. But so the they were, you know, a lot of these artists were quite radicalized by what was going on in the Depression. And Diego Rivera's mural for Rockefeller Center, this is in 1934, had just been destroyed, eradicated. And so the Coit Tower muralists gathered and issued a manifesto criticizing this. And to this day, you'll see some of the paintings in the Coit Tower really are about censorship and Marxism, so forth. So, and then, of course, right in the middle of this, the very violent general strike, where two protesters were killed by policemen. But and then the other interesting example of that is, I mean, it wasn't just Coit Tower, of course. The Golden Gate International Exposition, where Diego Rivera did his largest mural in San Francisco, which is now, I believe, at City College of San Francisco. And the Farm Security Administration, we have work by Dorothea Lange, who was just at that time divorcing Maynard Dixon, one of the painters and another local muralist. And so these connections just keep, you know, popping up in the most unexpected places.
Hmm. And one of the connections between the first section of the exhibition, which really looks at the muralist, and the second, is that Diego Rivera, when he was in San Francisco in 1931, of course, painted two murals. He did the Allegory of California, which is represented in Fertile Ground, and he also did The Making of a Fresco, which is a fantastic mural that is open to the public in the Diego Rivera Gallery at the California School of Fine Arts. And it shows Rivera sitting on the scaffolding, painting the mural itself in a sort of trompe-l'oeil fashion. And of course, by the time you get to the 1940s and the 1950s, Rivera, you know, was sort of out of fashion. And so that was not what the professors were encouraging their students to look at. But it's really an extraordinary piece that's open to anyone to go see.
Well, what seems interesting to me is that you have government funding through three of the four periods that perhaps did not intend the products that came out of those three or four periods. And it says a lot, perhaps, about the fact that there has been a decrease in the funding for the arts from the federal government, and what it makes me wonder is how would these movements have been different or not have existed or not have had the same impact had it not been for the engine that was fueled by government money. Any thoughts there?
I think a lot of it simply would never have happened. We think of Dorothea Lange and the photographs of the migrant farm workers. We all know Migrant Mother and her works. That archive simply wouldn't exist. But it's definitely true that with art, you can't predetermine what an artist is going to do. So that even in her case, when she was called on to photograph the internment of Japanese American citizens, her photography was so critical of the program that her photographs that funded her, that they were censored and impounded. Mm-hmm. And that certainly was true at Coit Tower.
So let's go to some callers. Again, let me put that number, 415-841-4134. And again, 415-841-4134. Let's go first to Matt in Oakland. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi. I've just been listening in and wanted to mention that there's a book called Painting on the Left, and it was published by the University of California some years ago. I'm not certain if it's still in print, but it is an excellent overview of Rivera's time in San Francisco and the profound influence that he and other Mexican muralists had on public art in San Francisco. And, you know, we obviously have a huge, there's just a great amount of public art that continues to be shown in places like the Mission Murals as well. So, you know, this is an influence, you know, that you can trace up to the modern day. And I guess I'd also just heard that they're restoring the murals in Rincon Center as well. And anyway, I just wanted to mention that, and thank you very much for the program.
Thanks so much for your call, Matt.
Thank you.
That book is still available, by the way. And I just the note talking about public art in various locations.
Painting on the Left.
On the Left. That's right. One of my great favorite discoveries in putting the show together was discovering that we had Sergeant Johnson's, who was one of the few African American artists painting murals at the time in San Francisco. It's like a 12-foot mural study for the relief mural that's currently at George Washington High School. And also good, it's just a beautiful thing that had been in storage for 25 years or more, and we're able to show it opposite a sculpture by Sergeant Johnson to really give an idea of his, you know, breadth of his work.
So Matt just mentioned in his comments there, Janet, that, you know, there's a vibrant mural tradition that still exists in the Mission District. It didn't show up so much in this exhibit. Why not? Or at least referenced more?
Yeah, interesting point. What we found so for the fourth section of the exhibition, you know, which is centered in the Mission, the, you know, your references to places like Clarion Alley or Balmy Alley, and I think that the way that you probably see it most directly in that last section of the exhibition is in the very large scale painting by Margaret Kilgallen. It's an untitled painting from the year 2000, which was she made toward the end of her life, one of her last very very ambitious pieces, and I think that those murals in the Mission were absolutely part of the, you know, the visual vocabulary that the artists who were active in the 1990s and beyond, you know, had in their heads. Also the, you know, the signs outside the store windows, hand painted storefront signs, and were things that were certainly influential to Kilgallen and others. But that the history of murals in the Mission is a huge topic and a whole other topic, and was one that was, you know, I guess beyond the scope of what we felt like we were going to be able to accomplish.
Perhaps another exhibit coming. Yeah. again, want to reintroduce the program, City Visions 91.7 KLW San Francisco. We're talking tonight with Janet Bishop of SFMOMA and Drew Johnson of the Oakland Museum of California. If you want to join our conversation, 415-841-4134, or you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Let's go next to Susan from Berkeley. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Hi there. I was a student of Wayne Thiebaud in the 1970s, and I'm really excited to see the exhibit, and thank you so much for tonight's program. What I have as a question is, because it was such a fertile time when I was at UC Davis, I was wondering if you're going to have any educational programs associated with this exhibit, and perhaps some of the living artists might be there, or there could be panel discussions. Just curious.
Yeah, we're still actually putting that together. The show has a very long run. It's actually up until April 12th. And so we're looking at some, there's a performance art program coming up in November. I'm not sure the date of a local Oakland art collective. Check the museum. Museumca.org is the Oakland Museum website, and just track that for updates on programs.
Excellent. Thank you.
Sure.
And before you go there, Susan, anything you want to say? Have you seen the exhibit yet?
I have not yet seen the exhibit, and I will see it probably several times. I can add that at the time I was at UC Davis in the 70s, we would see some of these artists just wandering down the hallways, critiquing each other's work, and it looked like they were having such a wonderful time inspiring each other.
Hmm. It's great to hear from a student. There's a moment in the show where I think it was maybe Arneson is quoted as saying, "Without the students, we were nothing."
It was a great time.
Great. Thanks so much, Susan, for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Janet, that reminds me that at the end of the Mission Scene exhibit, there's a video recording of many of the artists. Tell us a little bit about that piece.
Well, each of the sections of the show is supplemented with film footage, archival footage, and in the case of the last section, my colleagues at the Oakland Museum decided to interview people who were associated with the mission scene to try to just help communicate what it was all about. And so in that last section of the show, there are interviews with Jack Hanley, for instance, who's now based in New York, but had a really fantastic gallery that was one of the places where artists would gather on Valencia Street near 15th. There's an interview with Julie Diemer, who ran Four Walls, which was kind of upstairs from Adobe Books, and with Chris Johansson, one of the artists associated with that movement. So the footage is cut in such a way where each participant talks a little bit about what was going on at the time and then tends to point to someone else or another place that was important. I was fortunate enough to be at SF MoMA in the 1990s and to have worked with a number of these artists on exhibitions at SF MoMA, many of them through our Sika Art Awards project or series. So we presented the first museum show of Barry McGee's work. We did exhibitions with Amy Franceschini and Chris Johansson and Rigo and others. And so I was invited to participate in that video.
There was something written on one of the panels, and I'm not going to be able to remember exactly how it was put, but it was a sort of the San Francisco, New York thing.
Right.
Something about the hothouses of San Francisco, whereas in New York, everyone's kind of in their own corner. Tell us about that idea of the sort of the fertile ground, as you say, the hothouses, something that the nurturing environment of art and art makers here that's maybe different from other areas. Drew?
Well, that was a quote about California School of Fine Arts and the abstract expressionist scene there and comparing it to New York. And I think this is, and it's a defense of the San Francisco artists and what they were doing, and that, of course, we were fertile because we were all in one building, which is, of course, a little bit of an oversimplification. But it's not too far from the truth. And the building, of course, being the Art Institute. The caller mentioned the Davis and the sense of, the artists really enjoying themselves. I think that's also an example of the whole funk movement of the 60s and 70s is very Californian, and it's a defense of California art and having fun in art. Yes, one of my favorite pieces in the show is from the SF MoMA collection called California Artist, and it's one of Robert Artisan's great ceramic works. Must be a 6 foot tall ceramic bust called California Artist, and it's a self portrait that came about because of the criticism of an East Coast critic who was basically slamming California art for its provincialism in general, and Artisan in particular for being, his work was the product of a mind too easily amused by its own jokes, I think was the phrase. And so in response to this, he created California Artist, which is a self-portrait. And of course, Artisan did many, many self-portraits of him as an aging hippie with a denim jacket with no shirt, his guts hanging out. There's broken beer bottles and marijuana plants growing around the base of the sculpture. And then my favorite thing, which I didn't even realize the first couple of times I saw the work, he's wearing dark glasses or what appear to be dark glasses, and then you realize that you're actually looking into the empty head of the artist there. So this was, I think that just encapsulates the attitude of playfulness and fun and, belief in what they were doing despite what the establishment might say.
And now let's go to Ron, caller. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It sounds like an incredible exhibit. I'm definitely going to have to see it, but I haven't heard anything about a California movement that's happening right now that has international recognition and utterly stunning art involving hundreds of artists, and that's Burning Man. I wonder if you could comment on this incredible art movement.
Thanks so much, Ron.
I mean, there's probably a dozen other movements we could have looked at. I think the idea was to, I mean, we've had many conversations about doing exhibitions on Burning Man. I don't know if Janet has at SF MoMA, but our curators frequently attend Burning Man.
SF MoMA's director attended Burning Man this year, and I think one of the big challenges is to try to figure out how to translate what happens on the playa, this absolutely endless, vast, open landscape, into an urban center. But there is absolutely no question that Burning Man has fueled enormous creativity and is a major cultural force.
Speaking of the connectivity between artists, that's quite the example of it. And how do you reproduce that if you're not literally on the place, right? I wanted to talk a little bit more in the last few moments of the program about the collaboration, what that was like for you. You talked about the synergies and the opportunities that you could gain from pulling together your collections. But tell me about what you learned about each other as institutions. How did you merge styles or cultures or processes of two different institutions to come together for this exhibit? You want to start, Janet?
Sure. I mean, one thing that was important to me as SF MoMA was approaching our partnership exhibitions is to try to learn as much as we could from our colleagues. And so rather than coming up with exhibitions that we could organize from our own collection and then dropping them into the gallery spaces of another institution, for instance, it was really important that that each project, you know, sort of really fully take on the character of the host institution. So I found it really exciting to work with the team at Oakland and would describe, you know, their process as one that's very dialogue-based, one that involves a lot of voices, including many different staff members from throughout the institution, as well as community experts that came in from time to time to join the conversation and to help us think about the exhibition. So it's very, very different to actually work on a project together than it is just to, you know, meet at an art opening and chit chat for a few minutes. So I feel like we had it was a really great experience to learn from Oakland's approach.
Mm. And Drew.
It was a dream collaboration, really. I mean, there were times when early on when we weren't sure if how the OMCA style might be received, but I have to say
more about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's the interdisciplinary style. It's the context. It's the, you know, we show artworks right next to cases full of memorabilia, and so not that SMO has never done anything like that, but we have films running, we have scrapbooks that sit down with that are filled with memorabilia that a couple of assistants spent months putting together, and all I could say is Janet and Caitlin and Peter Samus, who's the interpretive specialist curator interpretation, were just really game for it. And I think both of us from both institutions have gotten real pleasure by seeing familiar artworks recontextualized and having dialogue with other artworks that they've never had a chance to do before.
Mm-hmm. And so then how do you feel like your museums are changing or have changed because of this collaboration? It's not the first time that museums have collaborated, but this particular one.
Well, it's unusual for museums to collaborate within their own communities. And, you know, usually if SF MoMA is organizing an exhibition with another museum, the museum is much more likely to be on the East Coast or in Europe, representing the venues of a traveling show. And so one thing that was really unique about this is that we also share an audience. We have overlapping communities. And so we both SF MoMA and the Oakland Museum have a real investment in engaging, you know, the communities of the Bay Area. And so that was really exciting to think about that together.
And as we started the program, you said that, you know, the genesis for this exhibit and many others like it over the last year and then another year or so till you reopen really came out of this idea of putting MoMA out there more, the on-the-go series, as it were. How is MoMA changing, or how do you think MoMA will change because of this experience of really going out there in a way that it might not have otherwise?
I think we're becoming increasingly audience-centric, visitor-centric, and very definitely want to continue to think about ways to extend our program beyond our own walls. You know, the specific form that might take is, you know, still remains to be seen. There's an awful lot that has to happen just to get us back into our building and reopen for our public in the spring of 2016. But it is really, really exciting to think about the potential, having had the experience of getting to know our Bay Area colleagues so much better.
Hmm. And Drew, what's your sense of where the Oakland Museum will go next as a result of this experience?
Well, Oakland Museum opened in 1969. It was as the Oakland Museum. It was before it was the Oakland Museum of California, although it's always had a California focus. And it was opened specifically as, quote, a museum of the people. And I think it's had really close community connections. I mean, projects were done with the Black Panthers in those days. And I think we really want to continue on our path, as Janet said, of being as visitor-centered as possible, of really making the connections between California's past and art and natural environment, and showing, you know, where the state is going.
So what's coming up next at the Oakland Museum of California?
The next most immediate thing is the 20th anniversary presentation of our Days of the Dead exhibition, which is speaking of community collaborations. It's a wonderful series of altars, usually by guest artists and sometimes by school groups and so on, and then culminating in a big community celebration in the museum gardens, which attracts, I think, 5,000 people last year.
And Janet, where is SFMOMA going next?
We have a project at CCA right now. It's a solo exhibition of the work of Marcus Schinwald that is part of our New Work series. And the final museum partnership will be held at the Museum of the African Diaspora. It's an exhibition called Represent, Portraits and Other Likenesses from SFMOMA. And it is organized by our colleague from Fertile Ground, Caitlin Haskell from SFMOMA, in partnership with Lizetta LaFall Collins for MOAD. And that will be the last in the series of museum partnerships presented by SFMOMA.
Great. So museumca.org is where people can go to learn about Fertile Grounds.
That's right.
And it runs until?
April 12th.
All right. So I encourage you to go and take a look. So that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Janet Bishop, the curator of painting and sculpture at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and Drew Johnson, curator of photography and visual culture at the Oakland Museum of California. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Joseph.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join my co-host David Onick next Monday as we discuss 50 years of the free speech movement. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.